Well, as you have heard, sometimes bad things happen to good people. And it seems unfair when innocent people are hurt or killed in an accident, tsunami, or a war, or a crime. And when our news media report on a death or an accident, it's often mentioned that the person was nice, was pleasant, cared about others, was kind, and was helpful. Well, the implication is that it's too bad that this happened to a nice person. Bad people deserve this, but nice people shouldn't have to put up with such tragedies. So why do bad things happen to good people? Job was a good person. He was a righteous man. He was blameless, and he maintained his integrity. He was a good person who had to deal with the agony of unjust suffering. In the wager between God and Satan, Satan is allowed to do anything to Job except take his life. Job lost all his animals, his servants died, his sons and daughters were killed. But Job did not blame God for these tragedies. His whole body is covered with sores, and he scrapes himself with a piece of pottery to relieve the itching. His wife tells him to curse God. His three friends come to see him. They hardly recognize him, and they're so upset at what they see that they tear their robes and they weep. They're so overcome at the sight of his condition that they sit there for 7 days without talking to him, because they see how great his suffering is. Well, that's an amazing lesson in listening. Sitting there for 7 days with a despondent person without saying anything to him. When they finally talk with Job, they point out that his affliction, his problems, are due to his sin. Job is obviously getting punished for his sin and needs correction. Job, this is your fault. Job's well-meaning friends are trying to comfort him. Unfortunately, their comfort comes in the form of religious platitudes. They try to justify the suffering. You must have done something wrong to receive this fate. This is God's will. Their explanations did not bring peace or comfort to poor Job. Job challenges their answers and their theology, and he continues to question why, and his friends continue to babble. Job is in despair. If I could only go back to the good old days, he says, to the time when God is watching over me. If I could be as in the days of my prime, when God protected my home. I was somebody. When I walked into town, old men listened to me. Now I am laughed to scorn by men of a younger generation. Terror upon terror overwhelms me. My soul is in turmoil. Pain pierces my very bones. God has flung me down in the mud, no better than dust or ashes. My blackened skin peels off, and my body is scorched by heat. Job's three friends look pretty silly, trying to explain what is beyond their comprehension. I think it's important to remember that, in essence, what they are doing is merely quoting the sermons that they've heard throughout their life and the affirmations of faith that they have spoken in worship. Their theological beliefs and systems of thought, which they assumed were written in stone, are being shaken up. Basically, they say to Job, don't lose faith. God will see to it that the wicked suffer and the good prosper. But Job was good. He wasn't wicked. So why suffer? Job's friends tried to explain, and they were not successful. His friends tell Job, you fooled us. You must have had a hidden life. We thought you were righteous, but really you aren't. You're proud, you're arrogant, and you're impatient. Job declares his innocence. I never stole, I never cheated, and I helped with the poor. Rabbi Harold Kushner, and I will refer to him, had a son who died at age 14, and he wrote this book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And after his book came out, he got a lot of letters from people about their problems. Problems with elderly parents, faltering marriages, death, and serious illness. He concluded that there was a lot of hurting going on, and that organized religion was doing a poor job of easing the pain. Pastors and religious people meant well, but usually they said the wrong things. Statements like, "In the long run, you'll be a better person for it," or "Be grateful for what you had," or "God only chooses the prettiest flowers for heaven," are well-intentioned, but usually hurtful. People going through sorrow need consolation, not explanation, Kushner says. Both Job and God dismiss the theological explanations of Job's friends. Job challenges our neat system of belief with the question that rings out across the ages: if God is all-powerful and all-loving, why are humans forced to suffer in this life? There is no good answer to this question when you're looking into the eyes of someone in pain. And we can't manipulate God into getting us some sort of result we desire. But Job is desperate for answers, and God does not ignore his questions. Job is not faced with silence, wondering whether God even notices his plight. God heard Job's questioning. Now it's God who asks the questions. "Who is this obscuring my attentions with his ignorant words? Brace yourself like a fighter," one translation I read said. "I'm going to ask the questions. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Have you commanded the morning since your days began and caused the dawn to know its place? Have you ever given orders to the morning or sent the dawn to its post? Have you any inkling of the extent of the earth? Can your voice carry as far as the clouds? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Who are you to even have an opinion?" At the end, Job says, "My words have been frivolous. What can I reply? I better lay my hand over my mouth. I better shut up." Well, God's response to Job does not answer his question regarding human suffering, nor does it support any of the arguments of Job's friends. God offers no explanation for Job's condition. He basically says to Job, "What do you know about running the world?" And Job has no answers to God's questions. At the end, Job says, "I know you can do all things. No plan of yours can be thwarted. I repent in dust and ashes." Well, reading Job reminded me of the apocryphal writings. And some years ago, Tina gave me a Bible with the Apocrypha, which I appreciated. And I've read most of them. There are some fascinating stories in there. And in the book of Esdras, there's a story about the prophet Ezra, who is disillusioned by the fact that the Israelites are in Babylonian captivity. The Babylonians are successful and doing well. The Israelites are once again slaves. Ezra is trying to understand God's plan. So God sends the angel Uriel to talk with Ezra. And Uriel says to him, "I've been sent to propound to you three of the ways of this world, to give you three illustrations. If you can explain to me any one of them, then I will answer your question about the way of the Most High. Here are the three questions. Weigh me a pound of fire, measure me a bushel of wind, or call back a day that has passed." Ezra says, "How can you ask me to do that? No man on earth can do it." Uriel says, "Well, suppose I had asked you, how many dwellings are there in the heart of the sea? Or how many streams feed the deep? Or how many watercourses above the vault of heaven? Or where are the paths out of the graves and the roads into paradise? You might have replied, I have never been down into the deep, I have not yet gone down into the grave, and I have never gone up into heaven. But as it is, I have only asked you about fire, about wind, about yesterday, things you are bound to have met. And yet you failed to tell me the answers. If then you cannot understand things you have grown up with, How can you, in your small capacity, comprehend the ways of the Most High? Ezra is frustrated, and he asks a very profound question. Why then have I been given the faculty of understanding? My question is not about the distant heavens, but about things which happen every day before our eyes. Why have your people, the people you loved, been put at the mercy of godless nations? We pass like a flight of locusts, our life is but a vapor, and we are not worth the Lord's pity, though we bear his name. What will he do for us? And the discussion goes on. Well, the Job and Ezra accounts remind us that wickedness, problems, and suffering are beyond the ability of people to control and to understand. Sometimes bad things happen to good people. At the end, Job responds to God's challenge. I know that you can do all things. And he is blessed by God. God restores his fortunes and doubles all his possessions. He ends up with 14,000 cattle, 6,000 camel, 2,000 oxen, 7 sons, and 3 daughters. And I'm sorry, that's the way they're listed. The sons and daughters come last. Job's 3 friends are reprimanded by God, because you have not spoken as you ought of me. In the passage from 2 Corinthians, Paul describes some of the adversity and problems he's faced in his work for the cause of Christ. Troubles, hardship, distress, riots, imprisonment, shipwrecks, sleepless nights, beatings, hunger, dishonor, and so on. Paul has suffered much misunderstanding in his work as an apostle, even from those to whom he has brought the gospel and to whom and who owe him so much. But he is not bitter. In the Mark passage, we have the familiar account of Jesus calming the storm. After a busy day of Jesus teaching the masses and then explaining the parables to the disciples, Jesus is tired and says, "Let's go to the other side of the lake." A storm comes up and Jesus is sound asleep. The waves are coming over the boat and it was nearly swamped. We were once in a boat in the Gulf of Thailand that it happened to be the tail end of a typhoon we didn't know. The water was splashing over the deck, and at that point I counted people and I counted life jackets, and the numbers were not in favor of the people. We survived that quite well. Well, you've got a big storm. The boat is nearly swamped. So finally the disciples wake Jesus and ask if he cares whether or not they drown. Jesus gets up, tells the wind to settle down, and accuses the disciples of having no faith. And they're astounded. Who is this, anyway? This account has 4 questions in it. The disciples' first question, "Don't you care about us?" This is the question of everyone who faces disaster, illness, death, or any calamity. Who cares about me? And essentially, it's a question about loneliness and abandonment at a time of crisis. If Jesus cared for us, surely he would do something. The second and third questions are from Jesus. Why are you afraid? And have you no faith? Now, we're not told whether Jesus goes back to sleep or what happens, but the disciples are puzzled and they talk to each other. Who is this guy? Who is this guy? Even the wind and sea obey him. Well, these accounts of Job, Ezra, Paul, and the disciples tell us that God will not always respond to our self-centered cries and complaints. There will be times when we feel like challenging God. And I wonder, when we challenge God like that, do we need someone to talk back to us the way God replied to Job, or the way the angel Uriel dealt with Ezra? Basically saying, "You're not going to understand this." Or do our friends do what Job's friends did and tell Job his disaster is due to his sin and give him platitudes? Well, God did not respond to Job or the Israelites in captivity promptly, but in due time, in a time frame they did not understand. Well, in conclusion, sometimes bad things happen to good people. We are not exempt from storms, danger, and threats to our life and safety. And sometimes there is no reason. When bad things happen, it's not necessarily because someone sinned. There will be wickedness, suffering, and pain, and maybe even disaster. It does not always help to ask the question why. Remember what God said to Job, "Who are you to even have an opinion?" Rarely will we understand the ways of God, and sometimes there is no reason. It's important to get past asking why and ask, what do I do now with the rest of my life? There is such a thing as random circumstantial suffering, simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some things are just circumstantial, and there is no point in looking for a reason for them. When facing the storms of life, we need to remember that Jesus is with us. And most importantly, we must all ask and answer the question the disciples asked. Who is this guy? Who is this Jesus?